This is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on there with Dr. Sydney Stark. And welcome to the Phantom Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I want to let people know we are live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. And we will also be later on Newsly. You can see that icon up there. We are a featured podcast on the Newsly platform. For those of you that don't know about that, you can check it out with the coupon code of GHOST. We will be on there later tonight with an audio version of the podcast. Use coupon code GHOST to check that out. We do have your drsydneystark.com/spark-call URL up. You won't have to remember that because you'll be able to click through that on all the major podcast platforms that we're on, but that link is available. And today we're going to be talking about how to tap into unshakable confidence. And before we start, we always ask two questions of all of our guests. What motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Oh my goodness. That's a huge question. So I think a lot of what motivates me are my kids. I have a 21-year-old and a 19-year-old, 21-year-old Jessica, 19-year-old Wyatt. And I always want to be the best version of myself for them, to show them what's possible in the world. And then why do I do what I do is just that when I was very young, way too young to have something like this happen to me, I was a victim of some childhood sexual abuse in my own bedroom, in my own parents' house. And I kind of made that mean for my whole entire life that I wasn't worthy of protection, of love, of respect. And so I spent the majority of my life, 30 years, being this ultra high achiever and always trying to be a perfectionist. And so what I realized probably took me till about 45 years old is that I can forgive myself for what happened to me. It wasn't my fault. And so it is my passion and my honor and my drive to go and show everyone else in the world that it is not your fault what happened in your childhood, and that you can love yourself and tap into that unshakable confidence and do whatever you want to in your life, regardless of your past circumstances.
Yeah, a lot of times people have these childhood traumas, and it gets like the imposter syndrome or not feeling you're worthy or good enough, and shame. And being around a lot of artists, because I'm a producer, and I would say that most singer-songwriters, when I run into them, they're tapping into that trauma. Like most of the creative people I've worked with always have some kind of trauma story. And they found a way to use art to be very therapeutic and cathartic to work through it. But not everybody knows how to do that. Right. So and even the artists I work with, sometimes they still don't really know how to do it. They think they're doing it with one leg of what they do with their work, but then they still have other issues. So it's interesting that you got into this work to help other people, but you also found you had to, you know, reach a moment where you still had to help yourself.
Exactly. You know, and you know, becoming a physician and caring for people, I think it just kind of drew it out of me as the time went by when I was practicing medicine. You see people at their lowest of lows. And, you know, I take care of a lot of people with traumatic brain injuries and heart attacks and strokes and kidney failure and amputations and all kinds of things. And so I think just being there at the bedsides of 100,000 patients over a 30-year period, it just really made me reflect on myself and kind of what all I had been through in my life, and kind of what it made me examine why I did what I did, made the choices that I made. So it's been full circle.
I think it's really important because sometimes a lot of times people are caretakers and then they don't take care of themselves. They feel like they've have a mission because of the guilt or shame to do that, but then they don't address it. And at some point it kind of builds up where they like a poet, we talk about the looking glass self. Mm-hmm. And when you start to examine that looking glass self, you can start to uncover it. But if you spend all your time like being a caregiver, you might not put a lot of time into the looking glass self. So you don't actually do the self-examination because you're paying your penance. And then eventually you have to deal with it.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. I have noticed a lot of doctors and nurses and everybody. I practice medicine in a hospital solely. I don't practice medicine anywhere else. But, you know, everybody from the secretaries to the environmental the environmental service staff to even the people in the cafeteria, I feel like they all are delivering care all the time. And it's kind of like that care that they wish could have gotten delivered to them. So you're spot on. Mm-hmm. I never thought about that with the poet and the looking glass. That's amazing. Never thought about that.
Well, yeah, it's like the creative, like I think there's a lot of creative energy in everything people do. And some people might think, well, doctors, they're not creative, but every human being to do what you do, you're using that creative spark, you know, and if you're a scientist or a doctor, you're using it in that way. And every situation is different and you kind of, there's an art to it. They actually like the art of science. There's an art to it. There's a science to it. And, you know, that's how a lot of things are. And so there's this balance in life. And a lot of times we find that we're out of balance. I'm a Buddhist and so I'm a lot about balance, and mm-hmm. spiritual balance, and pillars, you know, physical, mental, you know, heart-wise, body-wise. And sometimes a lot of people will start with something and say, well, I don't feel good in this area, this, but they'd ignore the other pillars. So if you just focus on one pillar, you don't have this holistic view, then you kind of out of balance and you wonder why do I feel so bad? Well, you might be out of balance in some way or out of tune.
Exactly. I felt like the more I went through my life, and I'm 54 now, but I guess I was about maybe 51 when COVID hit. And that really made me examine inwards and see where I was out of balance in my life. And I realized that instead of me trying to get all of this protection and love and honor and understanding and acceptance from all these people outside of me, that it would be really great if I could give that to myself. And so then that's when it kind of had this epiphany, like I'm the undergirding of that connector piece that makes me healthy, whole and healed. And yeah, I feel like so many people, if they'll get their mind in balance, but then not their body or their spirit, or they're really focused on health and weightlifting and all this stuff, but then they don't even think about their mindset and their spirit. It really has to be all three together.
Yeah, it's a whole holistic thing. See, a lot of people go to the doctor, but then they don't handle nutrition or they don't handle like the physical. So it's like the legs get out of balance, no matter what leg it is. And they, sometimes like you meet people like yourself, they're like high achievers, people with PhDs, people with certifications, with awards, and then they still don't feel good, right? They still, even though they have all these accolades, and you can run into like musicians that win Grammys, win these awards, thousands of views, billions of views. But then when you talk to them, they still don't feel they have the right to be on the stage. And you're like, what? And you're like, you're working with this person and they still have these issues, but they're like, you know, you don't get to know it until you really know who they are. And then you're like, wow. So they're putting on this mask. And how much is that taken out of them? That they have this mask and they really don't feel what they're showing. And then you're, wow, it's like, that's really weird. But being that's kind of like a lot of people are like that, whether you're a big star or not. I mean, you just, the people don't really know the real person.
Yeah, I never knew that. But just thinking about it, it makes me almost imagine, I don't know if I'm right with thinking this, but that they're just acting a part. Like they're not even being authentic to themselves. They're just acting.
Well, there's a lot of theater in the arts, no mm-hmm. matter what. There's a lot of theater. There's a lot of stuff that people put on because it's like they're expected to, and they kind of do. It's kind of part of the game. And, you know, you find that, like, whether you're in the corporate world, like you're in a board meeting, how many people are really showing their real face, you know, yeah. in front of the CFO, in front of the CEO, they're putting on their best face, and that's fine. But, like, is that really the truth? Probably not.
No, probably not. They're doing whatever they want to do, whatever they know is gonna, you know, maybe make them kind of melt into the background or be accepted for, you know, that image that they want to be seen as, or maybe to avoid discipline troubles. But yeah, they're a lot of times they're probably not speaking their truth.
Yeah, it's hard to be vulnerable. I find it's like a lot of times in life. Like if you want to be like in a flow state, you want to live in a present state, you want to not be so hung up on things and not trying to be so perfect. Then if you think about like, I like jazz, I like fusion, I like experimental music because it can go into like a flow state and you're not looking for the perfect note. You're not like trying to say, well, you know, there's no bad note. He's like, there's an opportunity. And that's a different type of mindset than something that's very orchestrated and very well, you know, produced, like an opera or a classical piece that's like well defined, versus something that has some room to grow and change based on wherever you are and whoever you're with. And I find that, like, if you can be in a flow state, then you can react to life, because life tends not to be totally something that you can plan. There's lots of unplanned things that happen. If you learn how to roll with the punches, then you can do better.
Yeah, completely. You know, my son, both my kids, my son and my daughter are musicians. And I'm just thinking about, you know, when they're up on stage and they rehearse as much as they can, but then when it's time to go live, you never know exactly what's going to happen. Even in the audience, you're kind of having to feed off of what's in the audience too, you know, what's going on all around you.
Yeah, and if you can let go, if you let go and you actually let it happen, every piece becomes its own, you know, like if you play live, that live piece is unique for that moment. And a lot of fans appreciate the fact that that is not exactly what was on the on the album.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people today, because we have tools, they want to make it exactly the way it was on the record. And that's very confining, you know. And so being a person's like, I don't necessarily need to make it note for note the way I originally wrote it. It's more fun for me to actually just change it based on whatever I feel like that day and how the audience is reacting. And I think a lot of people do that. If you think about like a public speaker, you could have a planned speech on your teleprompter. You start reading 15 minutes into the speech, you start reading the crowd and he's like, well, this isn't really working. So then you adjust for that moment, or you stay on track and then you kind of fail. Because like the house isn't reading it, but you still stick to the plan because that's the plan.
Yeah, we love to go to live music. And last year we went to a Wallows concert and a Taylor Swift concert. And each one, I mean, like she, like even the outfits being different makes you feel as a member of the audience, like you're a part of something special, or just what they'll talk about in between sets. Or absolutely, sometimes she or they, depending on which band we're talking about, they'll bring a trumpet player in. And then you're a part of something that no one else got to hear ever because you were there that night, you know? I love that about live music. Yeah. I love how it's not exactly like what the albums sound like.
Yeah, it is a big kind of push and pull today, because the ability with all these computers and music, not that I'm against them, but the technology has made it so that you could just go out and run to your master track and unmute your vocal and pretty much sing exactly what the way it sounded. And some people want that. Like if you go on a live show, they might want it to be exactly what you did. So if you go on like a live TV show, they might want it to be so close to the single that you really don't have a lot of room. And so, you understand what situation you're in. But I think what happens is, like, if you think about social media, somebody makes a post, cat videos get a billion views. So I go and I clone the same cat video and I take the same 30-second sound that was on the cat video. So just to get the algorithm to give me the same views, I just clone basically the same thing. But is that really me being an individual, or me just being part of the pack? Like, is that what you do to get popular, or can you be your vulnerable, authentic self?
Exactly. Yeah. I think unfortunately a lot of people are guilty of that. I know I have she's actually a neurosurgeon that I really respect. She works with me in the clinic that I used to be a part of. And whatever's trending, you know, they'll have those things on TikTok and Instagram. I think it's mostly TikTok. I don't have that social media. But I think there's certain videos that are trending. And then she will do it, you know, but whatever it is, if it's a dance or whatever. And they go viral because, everybody's just taking on that same little motif or whatever, that 30-second video. And anyway,
look,
in a way I guess it could be brilliant, but yeah, if you're trying to make music, it would definitely not be.
No, it's like there's a difference between being popular, because it's like some people always think quantity versus quality, right? So there are situations where people could have like a million views, but it's just something everybody's seen, right? If you put out something very vulnerable, very unique, and it only gets like 100 views. There have been scenarios where I've talked to people in the industry where, you know, somebody was just scouting things and they found the thing that didn't have a million views. They had like 100 views. And it was a very unique, vulnerable piece of original art. And then that drew their attention. And so people don't, it's like, just because it doesn't get a million views doesn't mean that somebody doesn't find it. And so you don't actually get the opportunity, but everybody's measuring things, thinking, I got to have 1,000 likes, I got to have 1,000,000 views. And then they said, well, if I don't have that, I'm going to give up. And that's probably like the wrong mindset.
Yeah.
You know,
I have one friend who actually she wants to only have the people following her that really, really like her. She doesn't want people that don't engage with her on her posts. And she knows that the more niche she is, she always calls it like, you're the ones who know how to get in through the back door, the secret entrance of the back door. And that's all she speaks to, are those few people that get her quirkiness, you know? And I love that about people. I love the individuality.
Well, it's like the law of attraction. Like, I like the way the way the world is with the net, you can kind of throw your work at the wall, where a lot of artists will hold back a lot. But a lot of times we don't know what the audience really wants. And so we hold back stuff, people that would have worked, but we don't know. But now because of the internet, I can throw a lot of my material out there. And I don't know what's going to work. And things that I think would not work actually work. So it shows like art, sometimes if you're a creative, like what you think is going to work is not actually what your fans think works. And so what you put out there, like you're kind of preventing yourself from actualizing because you're restricting so much of your output, looking for that perfect thing, and not understanding that some of the stuff you've done that you think is imperfect is actually what everybody's looking for.
Yeah. It's so true. And I also noticed that the more that you just like let yourself be loud and proud, you know, on stage, if you're a musician, the more that people like you because you're just real and authentic, and maybe you're really just not that polished at all. You don't have the voice lessons, but you're not trying to be so perfect. And so people love that. I know some people just don't even create a Spotify channel or don't even, you know, drop an LP or whatever it's called, a single, because it's not perfect enough. And so they just never, or they might put something on there and they'll pull it right back off. And it's just like, oh, you're depriving the world of your genius. Would you stop doing that?
Yeah. I mean, just to get it out. Yeah. If you think about it, like a Bob Dylan was such an impossibility, right? Because he's on Columbia Records with the voice he has. And that was a record label that was known for voices, like really high quality, perfect pitch, really melodic voices. And his voice is not anywhere in that. And so the fact that he was willing to go out there and people took a chance on him having a voice that was not the standard bearer, it was totally different. It was totally out of left field. Kind of like an idea of like a poet, like a Lou Reed is a poet. He's a spoken word poet and he got popular. And people would say, well, how could that work? Well, you know, it works because he showed up. He showed up and he kept on showing up. Even if people booed him, he showed. And so that's a hard thing to do because we're kind of in this popularity contest world that if you get that bad reaction, you might never come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I think it boils down to people needing to, accept themselves for who they are and not think they have to be everybody's cup of tea, because you can't be everybody's cup of tea, you know?
Yeah. I think it's about the fear of failure. Like you have a book called From Fear and Failure to the Finish Line.
Yeah. And, I have it right here.
And maybe you can tell the story of that, but like I think I've been kind of given examples in the music world of a lot of times it's like that fear really stops a lot of stuff from happening. And the people who have been a little bit more fearless actually do get benefits if they're willing to push it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So the funny story that you say that, because I had this idea at age 46 that I wanted to do a triathlon. And I was doing my training with two people, me and Lisa, you know, Lisa and I, she and I had never done anything but run a 5K together, 30-minute race. Okay. But then this other girl, Melanie, and bless her soul, she has passed away now. She was a dear friend of mine, and she was a professional cyclist in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And she could not get to the training bikes and runs and swims every day for 6 months. We had to do that. Run or bike or swim, you know, 6 days a week for 6 months. And she didn't even show up to the start line. But Lisa and I both crossed the finish line because we were imperfect, but we just did it anyway, you know, and we got to, you know, to live the experience and tell the tale. So that always broke my heart that Melanie wasn't with us there that day because she was the inspiration for it all. But anyway, fear of failure.
Yeah, it's really strange, but maybe you can. Yeah, I mean, like it stops so many people because the vulnerability is really hard. Because if you're vulnerable and authentic, you know, people take it personal when you get the bad review or you get the red marks or somebody says, you know, they hated it. And then you get wounded. And I think a lot of times even in life, like if you're given that report to the boss and he hates it, then your confidence level gets to an all time low. Like, how do you build back up if you don't feel encouragement? And then it's hard. It's a hard task to try, like, how do I do better if I can't get some kind of, roadmap to how do I recover from that lesson learned? You know, how do I make, you know, because a lot of times, like, you got to break some eggs to bake a cake. You know, sometimes the first one you did doesn't come out right. Dude, are you going to stop or are you going to perfect it till you actually do it right?
Speaking of cakes, I was just thinking that made me think about a story. I had just had my kids and we were hosting a dinner party and I wanted to make this new cake I'd never made before. And it was like one of those springform pans that were supposed to go in the oven and it's supposed to be in a water bath. I didn't read the little instruction that you're supposed to line it with wax paper first. And so I just put it in there in the water bath and the whole entire cake got soaked in water and the guests were like coming in the door and the cake was a soggy mess coming out of the oven. And my mom and dad were there and they said, you know what, Cindy, just let's drain it. Let's drain the cake while everybody's eating dinner. And it might be the best cake we've ever had. And sure enough, it was. And so every time I make that cake now, I make it just like I did before. You never know what you might find by screwing up royally.
Yeah, it's kind of like that no bad note. Like if you can figure out how to recover from it instead of throwing it out, like you find out like, oh, I can salvage this. But some people are such perfectionists that as soon as they see a slight any imperfection, they just like dump it. They like forget it. And I think it's the lesson learned is like a lot of times is like the people you're looking at, they're on the stage that's like really awesome influencer or their life coach. Like the first time they did it, they probably didn't do it perfect. They learned over time. But everybody thinks people go to 0 to 100 and they don't see the story of all the things that they had to go through to get to where they are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you want me to tell you the story about the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had trained for 6 months for this. My coach told me it'll take you 6 months to train for a half Ironman, or you can do a full Ironman. And I said, I don't know how to swim long distances and I've never clipped my feet into a bike. You know, those long distance bikers, you have to actually clip your shoes into the box. Yeah. Woo! I just hated that. It scared me to death. And my very first training bike, I fell and broke something in my thumb and I had to get reconstructive surgery and it set me back. Anyway, 2 years later, I completed every single bit of the training. I go out that day to do my triathlon. It's an Ironman triathlon. It's a 17-hour endurance event. It was about 2 hours of swimming. It's about 8 hours of biking and then followed at the end by a 6-hour run. Okay. And I was ready to do it, completely ready. My nutrition was dialed in, all my training was dialed in, but something happened in the ocean that day, and there was these 6 feet swells, 6 foot swells, and my nose clip fell out, and I was like inhaling all this water. It was just a really terrible, terrible swim. It took me way too long, and it made me slow down on my bike. Long story short, about 4 hours into the bike, about halfway done, they pulled me off the course. This van came up to collect me and all these other people behind me. And I said, "What is going on?" And they said, "You're going too slow. Like where you are at this particular point in the track, you're not going to finish by midnight, which is the cutoff." So they pulled us all off 8 hours into the 17-hour race. Oh, and I was devastated. And I saw all these grown men just bawling their eyes out. I had four people flown in to support me. I was so embarrassed, so devastated. But anyway, the book is about how I didn't let that be the end of my story. I said, you know what? I've trained for this whole thing. I didn't account for the water that day and how violent it was, because I literally did all my training runs at a pool and Lake Lanier right up here in Gainesville, Georgia, where I live. And so I hired a coach to teach me how to ocean swim. And I repeated the training for 8 more weeks. And 8 weeks later, I crossed the line, the finish line of my Ironman triathlon, and I got my medal. But that story is all about just how you got to, you know, work with everything that's in between your ears, that you got to tell yourself you can do it. Even if you fail tremendously and publicly, just get up and do it again. So I was so glad that I did that.
That's a hard thing, because a lot of times if people, you know, they can, you know, it's much easier to say it than to actually do it, because it's how you feel. Like if that disappointment kind of hits a trigger in yourself, you know, and then put you in the tailspin. It's like, how do you get people to get out of that? So the lesson learned is like, it is a unique experience to every situation, that, you know, failing is part of life. And a lot of people don't maybe like to talk about it. There are people who have kind of have whole, you know, conferences and mentorships and things and webinars about how you take these so-called failures and turn them into successes, because it's not 100% day one. Like that's a lesson that you have to learn in anything you do.
That's so true. And you know, it was such a eating humble pie kind of a moment. I was depressed for a couple of weeks, and my coach is like, "If you're going to do this, we got to get going, because you know, the next event." My first one was in Panama City Beach, Florida, and the second one was in Naples, Florida. And he said, "It's in 8 weeks, so you got to like dust yourself off and let's get back at it." And the last 8 weeks of the training is always the worst. You have like 21 hours of exercising in 1 week, because there's just such a long bike ride and such a long run every single week, and you got to repeat it for so many weeks. But, you know, I just said, I really don't want to just have it end right here. I've spent 2 years of my life training for it. So I only told one other person I was doing it. Of course, you know, my kid's dad and then my kids, they all three knew. But yeah, I just quietly repeated my training. And then as soon as I successfully crossed the finish line, I said, "Hey, I did it." I didn't tell anybody what I was doing, but I did it again. And it really inspired a lot of people, because some people can't even go out and get themselves to do a 30-minute exercise once a week, you know. And for me to have gone through that, despite the failures, was really kind of like pull yourself up by the bootstraps, kind of a teaching moment.
It's kind of like when you learn to ride a bike, you know, you're going to fall down. Like when you first learn a bicycle, and, you know, there are people who never learn to bike because they don't like that idea of falling down. So they just won't even try it because they can't get past the falling down. But a lot of things are like you're going to fall down, you're going to have to get up. And if you want to ride that bike, you got to get kind of over that. Exactly, you're probably gonna fall off.
So true. I mean, think about little kids that are learning to walk. They fall down over and over and over again. They get right back up. But I really think what it is that we are we're in a society where ever since we kind of were maybe middle school, we're so used to everyone looking at us and we think that everyone's judging us. And that's why we don't want to look stupid or not look perfect or whatever it is. But yeah, I just kind of felt like you just need to have the mindset of a child again and just be willing to screw up. Yeah. And you can read about things all you want to, but until you actually do it, you're not learning any of the lessons.
Yeah, it's like that childlike curiosity that you have before you get told that you can't do stuff, where you don't feel like you can. So that you jump on the skateboard and you hit, you scrape your knee, you start your rollerblades, you do stuff that like, well, like as an adult, like I'm never doing that because I don't want to, you know. But the kid is like, I'll jump on the skateboard, I'll jump on the bike, I'll go try to surf, I'll try to do it. It's like you do that, and it seems like we as they get older, you lose it or you. Or you have this big, like, kind of, you know, big crucible moment where you discover, like, I want to go back and find that inner child. I want to do that again. And I've been talking to a lot of people that, like, get to a certain point in midlife where they're willing to bring that childlike curiosity back and start to challenge themselves again.
Yeah, exactly. I will tell you, after I did that second triathlon, I mean, in my opinion, I did three because I did a half Ironman and then I attempted that one Ironman full one. And then I successfully completed the third one. So I kind of call myself a one and done. I said, I don't ever want to do that again, but I was really a three and done, but I didn't get bitten by the triathlon bug, so to speak. So I haven't done that again. But I still keep really active, but yeah, you have to, I think, really be realistic on what your motives are and just continue to pursue things that really light you up and excite you and make you happy, because the world needs all of us lit up.
Yeah. I think a lot of times we're not lit up because we get kind of into this routine, and it's kind of like a codependency. Like you might be comfortable in that codependency, but you're like not happy, but you know, you're more fearful of trying something new than getting out of the thing that's not satisfying, and you're kind of in a holding pattern. And so at some point you reach the crucible moment where it's like, I can't be in this holding pattern no more. It's like that now is not bearable. It's not comfortable. So now I'm going to push myself to go somewhere I don't know. And the fear of the unknown is like, oh, I'm scared. It's a wolf at the door. I don't know what that is. I don't know if I can handle that.
Yeah, you know, there's a deeply ingrained survival mechanism in our brain and our primitive brain that keeps us safe. And so anytime we hear something rustling in the leaves, we're going to think it's a saber-toothed tiger, but it might just be a little tiny mouse. So sometimes you really have to question what it is that you're afraid of, and could it be better than you're anticipating?
Yeah, it's like I heard something before that was really interesting. I'm going to go back into music. But David Bowie was talking about like this idea of swimming, and somehow you go into a pond and there's like a shelf where you could, it's a drop off. And he said, like, when you're a kind of like an artist that pushes the envelope, you're willing to go out in the non-shallow water where you could drop off and you feel like your feet aren't touching the ground and it feels uncomfortable, but eventually you start treading the water and you're in that new phase and you try that something that different. And that's a really, he was this really interesting analogy. I didn't probably say it right, but this is, he has this like known video statement where he's talking about how he used to like to go and tread water kind of push it, because he felt like if he could stay comfortable being one of his personas, like a Ziggy Stardust, he could have stayed in that for 10 years. He did it for like two or three, and then he moved to something else. Mm. And when he moved to that something else, it's like, I could have totally failed. Because he started singing with like Luther Vandross, and that's totally different than rock. And he's like, he wasn't that comfortable with it at first, but he's like, I'm treading water because I want to push myself. And so when you do that, when you go put yourself in an area that you're not comfortable with, you can eventually gain mastery if you don't let the fear overwhelm you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good analogy. And you know, there's absolutely no way to gain mastery without doing it wobbly at the beginning, period. You know, you have to put in those reps and get past your limitations that tell you that you can't do things.
Yeah, because you were talking about those clip-in. I'm a cyclist. I'm a mountain biker. And we use those clip-ins. And a lot of people, when they got into mountain biking, it's like, how can you be on a mountain bike and be clipped in coming down a mountain, right? Like, I want to be able to, but a lot of it, what we found is like, it was counterintuitive. Like, you need to be clipped in so that you actually have enough power to get up the hill and to stay on the bike. But being clipped in is kind of fearful. It's like, well, what if I need to jump off? But that's kind of thinking negative. You like, if you're putting this negative thought that I'm going to crash, so I need to get off. It's like, but you kind of got to get that out of your head and stay clipped in.
Yeah. That was my least favorite part, I think, of the whole thing, was learning that. And, you know, my coach had a brilliant way to teach me to do it, because I had never been clipped in before. And my friend Melanie, who was the initial, you know, idea, she had the initial idea of all of this. She stuck me in her clips, you know, her shoes with clips, and they were a size too big. And she put both of my clips into the bike. And that's when I, you know, went right out my driveway and crashed within 20 feet and broke my thumb and had to get reconstructive surgery. But my coach said, no, you don't need to do it that way. He said, I want you to be really comfortable. So I want you to bike for, I think he said, 4 weeks on using nothing but tennis shoes. And then another 4 weeks, one clip in shoe and one tennis shoe.
Oh, that's and a then, smart one.
And then I think maybe he had me even switch the other one. I had to have another clip in. And then he just, like, little by little, baby steps, painstakingly slow. He got me comfortable with all of it. And then Melanie took me out and she taught me how to brake unexpectedly, get out, you know, like put my legs kind of about in a triangle where position to increase my stability. And then it was fine. But so many people just would say, I'm not going to do that.
Well, a lot of times it's the all or nothing. Like, I've run into, like, you know, guys that when they learn the clips, they don't do the baby steps. They go right to it and they fall off, they crash, they wreck the bike, they break their fork, you get a collarbone injury. Because they say, well, I got to do it day one. I got to be clipped in, and they go down the hill. I don't know if it's a good idea to be clipped in and go down a creek bed if you don't know how to clip out. So it's like going 0 to 100. Sometimes people will say, well, that's the way you got to do it. It's like, sometimes that's not the path.
Not at all. But, you know, I learned so much about how sports can, you know, have so many parallels to life when I was going through all of that, because, you know, I can't remember that saying, and you might know it, but if you like, the more you bleed in training, the less you'll do something in battle. I can't remember that saying, but I went through so much. I would bike in the pouring down rain. I would run in thunderstorms. I would, you know, I would just do all kinds of things so that if I had all the adverse conditions known to man when I was training, then hopefully by the time race day came, no matter what I was faced with, I would
handle it.
And that's exactly what happened.
Well, that's like a lot of it, like, you know, is muscle memory. There's a lot of things in life that are very similar to sports and to music. Like, people don't think about music as being a team sport, but a lot of times if you're in a band, you got to treat it like it's a team, right? You all got to work together to get that song done, just like you're trying to get the play done. And so it's a lot of muscle memory. So like the athlete that does 1,000 three-point shots to get that three-point shot, well, the musician that plays, you know, 1,000 hours on the bass, so they don't have to look at it. They know where everything is. It's just there. It's muscle memory. So, you know, a lot of things, like if you do show up and you actually practice giving a speech, the first time you do it, you're probably not comfortable. You're freaking out. By the time you do it 100 times, you're starting to get comfortable. You're starting to be able to ad lib. You're starting to be able to kind of do flow state. Once you practice, it's like everything you do have to kind of learn how to train your brain and your brain likes knowing things. So if you practice in different situations and handle those curveballs, then you get more comfortable. Like if something happens, like you might not have every curveball thrown at you, but at least if you had enough of them, you figure, well, I can handle one, even if I don't know exactly what it is, but I've dealt with similar things.
Yeah. I had a business coach, Fernando, and he told me, you have to keep exposing yourself to the fear and get your body accustomed to that cortisol rush of just pure fear. Cause I was really uncomfortable making phone calls to people and seeing if they needed help with something. You know, I have a coaching business. And he said, you just got to face your fear, get used to that cortisol, and then transfer all of that, all those reps that you did as a doctor, just transfer that into being a business owner. And, you know, that is easier said than done. It's kind of like once you've done it once, you might think, oh, it's just going to be easy to do it again. But I was 20 when I was doing it as a doctor, you know, now I'm in my 50s. And so it's just so much societal conditioning kind of going against you. And, you know, my daughter, she's a psychology major, and she has brought this to my attention. You learn so much from your kids. I just love it. Every year they've been alive is my favorite year ever. But this year is my favorite because it's the most recent year. And so she's about to graduate with her psychology degree. And she said, you know, it's ageist if you think that older people can't learn things. You can't criticize the elderly. You don't even call them elderly. You just need to call them older. Don't call them old. Don't call them elderly. Just say they're older and they can do just as many things as you can do. And, you know, I think society though, at large tells us don't keep trying to do things. That's for when you were younger, but you don't have to believe that crap. You can just call bull crap on that.
Well, there's a lot of things that, you know, they try to say, well, that's a young person's game. Like in the music industry, like they pretty much, a lot of the people, they and our people, they say, well, this is like, you know, you got to be a teen to like your mid 20s is like the sweet spot. And if you come in as an older artist, not if you're a jazz or blues artist, you can get away with it. But if you're trying to do popular music, they're like, nah, that's not your space. But you have to like believe in yourself. If you've got a good song, you've got a good song. If you got a good piece of music, you got to believe it and you push it and you find a way to get it out there. And, you know, the people who believe in themselves, they find the law of attraction. They find like, hey, my audience is in Sweden. My audience is in the Netherlands. My audience is, there's a lot of independent artists. They find, oh, I have a worldwide audience, but it's not in this country. It's somewhere else. And I have to actually go there and then I find my sweet spot. So, like just by putting it out there, you find out through the law of attraction, like, oh, these people are the people that like my stuff. And then you can go to where those people are.
Well, I have a business coach. You don't have to stop. Yeah, true. I have a business coach, another one named Mark Von Muser, and he teaches us to condition your dream. And he always talks about, you know, condition what's in your mind into your heart. And you just said, just keep doing this. And visualize where you want to go and really like find pictures of the house you want to live in. Actively dream every single day of where you want to go in your life and what you want to be able to provide for your kids and the experiences that you want, and condition that so that you can literally see yourself, you know, stepping right into that preferred reality, just like what you said, the law of attraction. But you have to condition that. So, because everybody in society is going to tell you why you can't do it.
Yeah, there's a lot of naysayers. Like, you know, but I've always liked the kind of look at the bell curve. I've always been into the people who are on the outer edges. I've always looked into the underground movements and kind of like, you know, college radio stuff. And then things bubble up. You know, you get different periods of time where there's something that was underground and it suddenly becomes mainstream. Well, it didn't come out of nowhere. A lot of times it was bubbling up in this other area. And then it kind of gets critical mass and comes out. And so, like, a lot of times people just think, you know, where'd that come from? There's a process, and it's usually because people are passionate about what they want to do. The passion can drive that law of attraction. And then suddenly something, you can get that kind of, you know, buzz. The, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, whether you're an artist or not, but if you get started getting that buzz, then suddenly people find out and they start being drawn to you. And then it just kind of exponentially happens. And if you really, you know, have affirmations about, like you said, you like, I see where I want to be. People feel that because like right. People radiate like energy. So if you radiate positivity and determination, people mm-hmm. around you are going to feel that. And they're going to probably, you know, start being your group, your tribe, and then they're going to help you. And you're going to find people that help open those doors because you have that mindset.
Yeah, that's a great point. How did you, when you were saying a little while ago, how some people might find that their ideal audience is in Switzerland or the Netherlands, how do they find where those listeners are?
Well, the way the world works in music, you can put things out there on these platforms. They're kind of like underground platforms. And they kind of show you, like an example is like SoundCloud is not, it's kind of where underground artists are. It, okay. When you're on that platform, it tells you where your people are. It shows you where people are listening. Oh. And so it actually shows you by country and by what city. And it's not Apple and it's not Spotify. It's not Amazon. It's just like underground kind of area. And there's like mixtape platforms. There's all these kind of underground platforms. And they, you know, with the magic of modern technology, they tell you like where your streams are coming from and what cities and what countries they're coming from. And then when you see that, then you say, oh, I need to find a booker and play that city because I got all these people are digging my stuff here. So then you kind of know where in the world before you wouldn't know. You played a pizza shop, played a bar. You hope some A&R guy finds you. Now you can actually put it out there and then see where the people are actually like you.
Okay. Well, I know on Spotify, because like I said, my son has an album there. He can see where his listeners are coming from. And they're not all from the United States of America, even though, you know, we're based out of Georgia. Some of them do come from somewhere else. But I don't know if they tell the specifics, like what you were just talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Some places, like, they have the tools. And, you know, they have a certain tool on Spotify that tells me some of that, too. But, like, some of it is, like, these other platforms sometimes are good for kind of building. If you're an independent artist and you kind of want to run your own game, you can kind of drive things that way and build your own website, sell your own merch. There's just like a lot of people that don't necessarily want to get signed anymore because they want to own their vision and they want to know where they want to be. And they kind of work in terms of like learning the business. So then you can't just be an artist. You have to learn, like, how do I market myself? How do I learn SEO? How do I do this? How do I get a booking agent? How do I get booked in that play club in Iceland? Or Netherlands, they go find out and then they go do it.
Yeah. Set themselves up. Okay. That is fascinating to me. I had no idea.
Yeah. It just depends on what you do. You know, my daughter is a graphic artist and she works with graphic artists. They're into helping people who are disabled artists. And she's become an art director for people who want to have virtual spaces for disabled artists. So virtual galleries to be able to show work that the traditional galleries don't have. And she started getting, like, she's been able to, you know, make an income on it and move forward and do a lot of cool work. And it was an idea she had that she thought that this group of people should have, be able to have a place to display their work. So they started doing these virtual galleries. And so there's a lot of things that you can do. Like if you believe in it and you want to do it, you can start to do it.
Is she disabled?
She has some disabilities, yes.
Okay. I was wondering what, if she had a friend or somebody in the family or her herself.
Her own disabilities kind of motivated her to you know, her own issues with trying to get into gallery spaces and not being accessible. And she said, like, I'm going to start advocating for not only myself, but for everybody that has this issue. And then, you know, it's been like her passion and that's what she does.
That is fantastic. It really seems like a lot of people who you know, start these amazing things, it's always because, you know, like we were talking about with doctors and stuff before, it's because they had a need and they wanted somebody to be there fighting for them like that. So, yeah. So she's being her own advocate by making this space for other people, other disabled artists.
Yeah, I think that's a big challenge, you know, because like sometimes like if you don't have a venue, then you create a collective and you create your own venue.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like when if you're a band and you can't get booked, like then you go find a bunch of bands and you create mm-hmm. a collective, and then that collective goes to the club and the whole collective gets booked. And then you take over that club for the whole night or for the whole week or for the whole month. And that's been like the modern strategy. Like, okay, if I go by myself, maybe I won't make it. But if I go find like-minded individuals, we create an artistic community, we can all then go and pitch something that's like, hey, we can have all these people come and watch us all night or all week or all month. Then the club says, oh, okay, but I'll book you.
yeah, because they want customers.
Yeah.
So yeah, they want liquor sales or food sales or whatever it is, you know, you got to think about, or even the ticket to get in the door. They're looking for their bottom line too.
Yeah. So it's just a lot of times it's creativity and passion. Right. And so like, even though the door was locked, you could open it a new door that wasn't there, but right? You can go and create a new space for yourself by being more, you know, thinking kind of like holistically and solving the problem. And so I think a lot of things I would like to maybe dive into are like lessons learned from like reading your book or your life as what you're doing now, in terms of like what could the audience get out of like the idea of this unshakable confidence and like lessons learned or examples.
Yeah, well who I really feel like kind of is drawn to me more than anybody are people in the middle half. They're like the middle section of their life, 35 to 65. And they're at a crossroads, whether they have had a death of a spouse, whether they have had a death of a mom, or maybe a cross country move, or they can't speak up at work, or they are going through a divorce, or they're becoming an empty nester, like any of these big life things that happen to people. And they just don't know how to have the confidence that they're going to get through that. Well, I come in and I help them literally person by person, place by place, kind of unwind anything that ever happened to them from birth till current age that could have inhibited them or implanted like false limiting beliefs or negative beliefs. And so it's called the trauma release method. And that's what we do together, is we turn people into being not confident and not passionate and just not feeling strong and powerful in their life into these amazing badass, you know, very, very confident versions of themselves, because they realize that they have the power themselves to, I call it resourcing your inner children, that little 7-year-old version of Cindy, that little 30-year-old version of Cindy that different things happen to. You can, through meditation, like a subconscious meditation, actually be your own best advocate. And then you kind of present yourself with cleared filters, and everything is there kind of possible for your life. And, you know, I just really want people to know that no matter what they've been through, that they can turn it around. And you have to have a person who is willing to help you, hold space for you, and help you walk through anything that may have been inhibiting you from birth until now.
Yeah, it's like a lot of the things that inhibited you are like assets that you can use to help tell stories and lessons learned on how strategies on how to take these moments instead of being shamed by them, leverage them. Like yes. I've found is a lot of people, once you learn how to leverage those things that really hurt you or stopped you or were a hindrance, but then you learned things about those moments that where you could actually you find the nugget that's like, oh, this is how I should react to that. This is how I should respond to this if this happens in the future, and how I can build from it.
Yeah, and it's almost like you're turning that, like, your worst part of your life into your superpower. Yeah. Is what it really ends up being. And you know, I always tell people, when you just sit there and try to effort yourself to death, you know, and you're not in flow, but you're just like, go, go, go. You're working from this frontal lobe. It's called your conscious mind. That only controls 4% of the whole power of your brain. And if you can get your subconscious mind cleared out and on board with the frontal lobe and working with 100% instead of 4, like, this frontal lobe, the conscious mind, is never going to win in a battle of all these programmed beliefs that you were just indoctrinated with ever since you were like a sponge, because that's just kind of like how childhood development works. And so people just think, oh, all I got to do is just have a little bit more willpower or make some more lists. Well, I'm just here to tell you, if you can harness the power of all this, things will happen very, very quickly for you. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I feel like none of us are getting any younger. And if you have things you want to do in your life, you know, time is a wasting, you know, and it's just no time like the present to have the best version of your life.
Yeah. Because if you wait till you're retired to do your dream things, then retirement sometimes might disappoint you, because you get to that point and you might not be capable of doing those things. So if you find a way to integrate your dreams into the now, right? Like, that's what I try to do with a lot of people, is like, you don't have to be a starving artist, but you have to actually show up, right? Can't say, well, I have to actually work at it, right? So if I want to work on that, I can't wait till, oh, when I'm 70, I'll do it. I'll go do my concerto. Or like, why don't you try it like now?
Yeah.
And space out some time. Because you're going to be better able to do it at 55 than at 72. Not that you can't do it at 72, but if you wait till then, other things might happen. So sometimes you have to kind of, you know, not that you can't do it when you're 72, but, you know, like, if you delay the things that you're really passionate about, then I don't know if you're ever going to do it. Because this is like the procrastination, you know, situation, and you never really get to it.
That's right. I'm still in touch with my teacher. He's my gifted teacher from elementary school. He taught me like third through sixth grade, and he's a pianist. And I go over to his house like every 6 months. He has this huge recital, and he's in his 70s, and he's been doing it forever. And he just gets better and better and better.
Yeah, it's just amazing. If you stick with it, like a lot of people, like, they're, you know, I met musicians when I was 18. And because they didn't hit by the time they're 23, they gave it up, and their guitar's sitting in their basement. And they never pick it up anymore. I'm one of these guys with the guys I, you know, hang out with. We kept on playing, regardless of whether or not we got in the top 10 or top 100 or got a record deal. We do it because we love it. And because we love it, we just play because we, the love of the playing. But sometimes people have other things that they were doing the playing for. And then if it didn't hit that goal, then they gave it up. So I don't know if they really loved playing guitar, if now that guitar's sitting in the basement.
Exactly. I mean, like, my dad's a guitar player, and he said that, and my son and my daughter both are too. And he said, it's almost like you want to play it so much that you end up falling asleep with it in your hands. Like, yeah, your hands, like, are on it all the time.
Yeah, that's the people who keep on playing until they can't play. You know, you get blues guys to play until they're like, they're not here. Okay? They never stop the Delta blues. Like, nobody ever puts an age limit on the Delta blues. You can play the Delta blues till you're gone. You know, like a lot of jazz musicians, you can play jazz until you're gone. It's only like in the popular music, they say it's like an age game. But like, oh, you got to be young, you got to be that. But other forms of music, you can play like classical until you can't do it. So like you, if you're passionate about it, you don't have to, oh, it's a young person's game. No, you can do it. If you love it, you can do it. The question is, do you really love it?
Yeah. I took the kids to New York for Christmas time, and we went to a jazz club, and they were a lot older musicians, and some of them were sitting down. And I love that, because, you know, sometimes it is hard to stand for an hour long performance when you get really, really old. And so they just sat, you know, and it was the best jazz show ever. It was underground. It was down in this area I've never even been to in Manhattan. It was just the best show ever. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, when people are just passionate about it, they just do it. You go to New Orleans, you can see that. You can go to Texas, Mississippi, you can see people who are like whatever age, and they can still do it because they love it, right? And if you're passionate about whatever you do, a painter or whatever, or, photographer, theater, you don't have to be on Broadway to do theater. You could be doing theater in your local theater. Just like you're passionate about playing roles in Shakespeare or doing one act plays, doing Death of a Salesman, you want to do it. And so you find a way to do it. And so the
So
people who say they want to do it, but then they never do it, it's like, well, it's about like, do you, are you going to actualize or not?
right, exactly. Well, I'm just really glad that there are so many people that are so full of talent that we can enjoy their talent. We go to Broadway musicals every chance we get, and we have memorized all the lyrics to all the songs, and it just makes for a really nice thing to kind of be into because there's always a new play coming up,
Well, it's just cool to be into the arts or just into the creative space and understanding that creativity is like for everybody. It's not for just artists, Everybody can be creative. They can get that spark. And then you find out like that spark is what makes you that childlike passion that gets you into whatever you want to do and makes you stop saying the no or stop saying, I'll get to it later and actually start doing it like now.
Yep, that's so true.
But like you have your spark call. And again, maybe you can talk about like if people click on your link, drcindystark.com/spark call, what happens when they click on that?
Yeah, so that's my website, drcindystark.com. And what I offer people is a spark call. It just takes you to my calendar page on Calendly, and we can book a 15-minute call and see if there's anything that I can do that you're suffering with and struggling with in your life that any of my tools could help you with, and just see if there's any of my programs, or even if it's, my book that they might need, or a Facebook group that they could join. It just kind of lets me have 15 minutes with the person and see what's going on with their life and how I can help them get to the next place in their journey.
Well, we do encourage our audience to be able to click on that. Like once we're fully published on all the platforms, we're on all the major platforms that podcasts can be listened to and watched. And so that link will be fully clickable. You don't have to remember it. You'll be able to click right through it. So again, we've been live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. We will be on all those other platforms like Apple and Spotify and iHeartRadio, a bunch of other ones by tomorrow. Again, I want to thank you for being a guest on a Family Like It Goes podcast. And I appreciate it. And I hope you have a good night.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to serve your audience.
Thank you.